Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of August. This week we have for you, as the core part of our program, part two of an encore of one of my favorite shows of last year, a show that we recorded with Dr. Jerry Freilich, the former research coordinator for the Olympic National Park, as well as director of the North Coast and Cascades Science Learning Network. Jerry is passionate about environmental conservation and trained as an entomologist, and we spoke with him about a subject very dear to his heart, bees and biodiversity. We also have our stalwart sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, here to help share current observations and upcoming events. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi, Deborah.
But before we go any further, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this one is that the diving sounds are as distinctive to identification as are the vocalizations. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
The most notable news of the past week has been the heat, along with the post-apocalyptic haze that has blanketed our area. As most of you know, the haze has been caused by the major fires burning to the north of us in British Columbia since April. Almost 900 wildfires have scorched over 1 million acres in southern British Columbia, with most of these fires caused by lightning storms occurring in the area on July 7th. Most of the fires are under 5,000 acres in size and burning in a mix of grass, sage, and scattered timber. The area burned this year by wildfire in BC has hit a 56-year high. It pales, however, to what happened in 1958, when fire spread across more than 2.1 million acres of land in British Columbia alone. The haze has been a very vivid reminder of how good our air quality usually is in our area and how important it is that we work hard to keep it so.
We're hoping that the smoke haze is out of the way by this weekend or around the 10th of August, because we have the most notable meteor shower of the year happening, the Perseid meteor shower, and it peaks around August 12th. So we'll hope that we can see the stars and the shooting stars by then. On our show last month, Kate Dwyer had written in to tell us of some mountain goats that she'd seen up Klahani Ridge in Olympic National Park. As most of you know, mountain goats are an exotic species on the Olympic Peninsula, having been introduced to our mountains back in the 1920s for sport hunting, before the Olympic National Park had National Park designation. The goat population has exploded, with no natural predators to check their numbers. Since wolves were extirpated on the Olympic Peninsula about the same time that goats were being introduced, in a great irony, and that population of goats has become a threat to sensitive alpine plant species, as well as to human beings.
There have been several efforts made to remove them from the park, which have had limited success. The census taken last December found their number having doubled in the last dozen years, with the estimate up to 620 animals. As a result, the park is talking again about making another concerted effort to get rid of them, including translocating them to the Mount Baker Snoqualmie and or Okanagan Wenatchee forests, where they are native and where populations numbers have been low in recent years. The Olympic National Park has scheduled a series of public meetings in mid-August, as well as taking comments on what to do about the problem. The draft EIS is available for review and comment at parkplanning.nps.gov/olymgoat, with the time and dates for the informational meetings posted there also.
On Nature Now last week, Nan Evans threw out a question to our radio audience, wondering if butterflies seemed more abundant than usual to us this year, and wanting a recommendation for a good butterfly guide to this area. I have not noticed an increase in butterfly numbers in my wanderings, but I can recommend a great butterfly guide. About 15 years ago, Robert Pyle put out a wonderful field guide called The Butterflies of Cascadia, which is packed with beautiful photographs and lots of information about our local species. And while I haven't noticed more butterflies than usual, I have noticed fewer wasps than usual. I hope I'm not jinxing myself by saying this, but I haven't seen as many as usual, and I was wondering if anybody else out there has noticed the same. I know that yellow jackets are wonderful decomposers as well as very important predators on plant pests, but I cannot help but be thankful when I'm hiking off trail to find a lot fewer ground nests this year. And now on to our main topic for today, bees and biodiversity, with Dr. Jerry Freilich. When Jerry joined us last month, the conversation focused on biodiversity in general, but today Jerry's going to be speaking about bees as a great example of the biodiversity that commonly exists all around us, but don't often recognize. So thanks so much for joining us once again, Jerry.
Hi, Devrin. Just delighted to be here.
This would be a great time to remind folks that while Jerry was mostly known on the Olympic Peninsula for his position as research coordinator for Olympic National Park and as director for the North Coast and Cascades Science Learning Network, that he got his PhD in entomology, studying stoneflies in Wyoming. And he has the best story ever about how he started down this truly unexpected path. Would you please share this story with us, Jerry?
Sure. Those of you who are listening to my last installment know that I was a young student at the Academy of Natural Sciences, the Natural History Museum in Philadelphia, when I was a very little boy. I was a student there when I was 10, 11 years old, and I was a curatorial assistant in the museum when I was 11 and 12 years old. I went on then to have various jobs, including I worked at the museum full-time as head of the live animal department in the 70s for 6 years, and then I went back to graduate school at Cornell. Now, all of this time, even though I was working with animals and very involved with natural history, very few people knew, and of course I hid it very closely, the fact that I was squeamish of and terrified of insects.
Just makes me laugh.
Right. Well, now I just found them sickening. I could not look at an insect close up. I could not even look at pictures of them in a book and eat at the same time. Couldn't do it. I was really, really squeamish of them. Well, then I got to graduate school at Cornell, and here I'm getting a master's degree. And my major professor said, listen, it says here you don't have any entomology. You have to take a course in entomology. I was terrified. I argued with my professor. I said, look, I'll take another foreign language. I'll take computer language. I'll take an extra course in statistics, anything, not entomology, please. He said, if you think you know about nature and you don't know about insects, you're fooling yourself. He said, no, my boy, it will be entomology or you're not in this program. You cannot imagine the fear that I had, and I knew that that first day in that entomology class, we were going to look at insects through the microscope. And I knew that I was either going to run screaming out of the room and throw up in the hallway, or I was going to get over it. And I'm not exaggerating this at all. I was terrified. Well, it did happen. And it did help, of course, that there was like 20 other kids in the lab sitting there looking through the microscopes. So I was a little bit self-conscious, perhaps. But the most amazing thing happened. I had been so terrified of insects all my growing up years, but when I looked at them through the microscope, amazingly, instead of seeing this big scary thing with all of its scary parts, instead I realized, oh my goodness, these little animals are made up of armor plates that fit together like knights in armor.
Wow.
And the little plates have these little hairs and these little joints and these little amazing colors. In a word, I got over my fear in a single day. And the reason I tell the story is because no matter how feared you may be of something right now, These wonders of our natural world are all part of the ecosystem that keeps us alive. And if you just look at them carefully, you can accomplish this kind of thing yourself. I've gone forward from that day knowing that even these deep fears can be conquered and relatively easy in my case.
Well, that's so
I took one entomology course, then a second, then a third.
And then you got your PhD
and
in entomology.
And I ended up with a PhD in entomology.
Well, it's a really inspiring story. I love that story. Thanks for sharing that. Since insects are such a huge part of environment, you have an example again of the five families slide and the species scape illustration that you showed us.
We touched on this in our last show together, but basically most biodiversity, most species that have been named so far are insect species. Insects account for a huge number of the species that exist. And last time I talked about a slide I show where there are five families of carnivores, like dogs, cats, bears, and so on. And then I showed another slide that showed five families of flies. Well, today I'd like to talk to you about bees. And I would make the point that if I showed you a picture with five families of bees,
it would all look
like they're all the same. I mean, not the same, they're different, but our English language doesn't help us. To our common language, they're just bees. Now, when I ask people to name how many kinds of bees they can name, most people will say, okay, honeybees, mason bees, bumblebees, and that's about it. So it's always a shock to learn that there are somewhere between, say, 3,000 and 4,000 species of native bees in North America.
That's just astonishing. But even more astonishing, didn't you tell me that there are like 400,000 species of wasps in North America?
Well, I don't think anyone knows how many species of wasps there are, but we should clarify that when we're talking about bees, that bees and wasps are both in the order Hymenoptera. The bees and wasps and ants are all Hymenoptera. But bees and wasps are totally different. And the wasp world is hundreds of times larger than the bee world.
And bees derive from wasps,
yes,
right?
The bees are a specialized group of wasps.
And when did the bees evolve?
Okay, the bees came about sometime around the time when dinosaurs were disappearing. So it's the end of the Cretaceous era, 100 million years ago. And this is around the same time that flowering plants started to diversify. So actually, beetles were probably the first pollinators of the earliest flowering plants. But the bees came along right at that time. And as flowering plants started to diversify, the bees started to diversify also. So by the time you come to the Paleocene and the dinosaurs are now extinct, at that point now we have bees and bees and bees and bees. But again, remember the bees, they are a much smaller world than the wasps that they came from.
So what makes a bee a bee?
It's not easy to describe, actually, in lay terms. People always ask me that question, and it's more difficult to answer than just to say, well, a bee looks like one. Mm-hmm. That doesn't help very much, does it?
No.
There are some bees that look very much like wasps, and there are some wasps that look like bees, too. So it's a difficult thing. Bees are characterized by several technical differences. One difference is that bees are almost all vegetarian. Most wasps are carnivorous or predaceous or what we call parasitic. But the bees are a vegetarian group. You think about it, they gather nectar and pollen, and they use floral resources in a variety of different ways. Another technical distinction of bees is that the little tiny microscopic hairs on a bee have hairs. In other words, the hairs have hairs. And you can only see that under the high magnification of a microscope. Mm-hmm. You can't eyeball that. And the third technical point makes a bee a bee is that a lot of bees have a tendency towards sociality. You all know that honeybees are social insects.
And honeybees are non-native.
Honeybees are non-native. They don't belong in North America. They were brought here by European settlers. They're native to Europe. And when I talk about bee diversity, I'm not talking about honeybees. In fact, as a beeologist, I really have no patience or interest in honeybees at all. And I know a lot of our listeners are very interested in honeybees because honeybees are so important to our agriculture. Honeybees make big hives that store honey, which allows them to live through the winter and have food during their year. Uh-huh. But the honeybees are the only bees in North America that make hives, that have big colonies, and that store up big resources for the winter. All of our native bees, all the thousands of native bees, are very, very small colonies, typically 50 or 100 bees at the most. Uh-huh. And many of them are just really solitary, just individuals living lives that are totally unknown to you and me walking through the trails in Olympic National Park.
And as a result of that, they aren't nearly as subject to hive collapse. I mean, the reason why the honeybees are having such issues is that they live in such dense colonies, right? You know,
right.
30,000, 60,000 bees together.
Right. Honeybees, of course, are critical to our agriculture. And we've already touched on why that's so, because they store honey. We need the honey. And they also are in large numbers, so they pollinate a lot of crops. And also, because the hives are in a box, you can transport them from place to place, as commercial beekeepers do. So yes, they're tremendously important to agriculture, but it also makes them susceptible to disease that comes in.
Kind of like a monoculture.
Like a monoculture of a cornfield, perhaps. So colony collapse disorder and varroa mites and a bunch of other problems, which we're all very concerned about, the role of neonicotinoids in the environment. These are various things that the beekeepers and the general public are aware of. It is not known to what degree our native bee species are prone to those same problems. But the simple fact that they are small colonies widely distributed all over the place makes it much less likely that they would be brought down by any one disease or problem.
Well, sorry, I got you off track with the honeybee issue because you were starting to tell me a little bit about sociability.
Right. Well, social insects like bees and the other great example is termites. Social insects are characterized by three characteristics that maybe your listeners never even thought about. The one characteristic of a social insects are that they have a division of labor. So you have worker bees and you have a queen bee and you have drone bees, and most everybody knows that. In the native bees, our native bees that are either very primitively social or unsocial, they don't have distinct castes like workers and queens and so on. They're more all alike. Uh-huh. So another division in the social insects is that they have division of both what they look like and also in their jobs. And the third thing that makes social insects is the overlap of generations. Like social insects have the mother surviving a long time and the workers survive a long time so that they take care of workers that come along. Uh-huh. So there's an overlap of generations. In most of the non-social insects, the mother lays an egg and then she may never see her young. Uh-huh. The mother will typically die or go somewhere else. They don't see the young. They don't progressively provision. They don't bring food continuously to their offspring. Uh-huh. So that's the difference between a social insect and a non-social one.
So while we have thousands of species of bees, they're generally grouped according to their life patterns so that we can sort them out, right?
The bee families have long histories. And just as we talked about families of carnivores, there are families of bees. And to you and me, perhaps, they all look the same. You have to look at them under the microscope to tell them apart. Some of them are easier to tell apart than others. For example, the Megachylidae, and is there a common name for them? I don't think so. The mason bees are megachylids. They don't have pollen baskets on their hind legs. They have specially modified hairs under the abdomen, and they carry pollen on these special hairs under the rear of their abdomen. So that's one where you can tell that family just by a quick look. But these other families, the Halictidae, the Andrenidae, the Calidae, the Anthophoridae, the Xylocopidae, these are just Latin names that would probably mean nothing to most of your listeners. But those are the families of the bees. They have long histories. And the scientists who have been working on these for a couple hundred years have figured out who's related to who using characters that you have to look at under the microscope.
How many species of bee do you think we have here on the Olympic Peninsula?
If there are something like 3,000 or 4,000 species of native bees in North America, I think probably a good guess is that we have like 700 or 800 species up here in the Olympic Peninsula. The Park Service was involved these last several years with a service-wide effort to find and identify as many bee species as we could. And being the research coordinator for Olympic National Park and also being an entomologist myself, I participated in that nationwide assessment. So for a couple months each year for the last several years, we laid out little bee traps, caught as many bees as we could, sent them all to Patuxent, Maryland to be identified. The Park Service has an active science program to try to get some handle on that.
And you were telling me about a great series of videos that the park put out about their scientific research, right?
Actually, most people are very little aware of how much research goes on in the national parks. It's really quite amazing. If you go to www.nwparkscience.org. It's NW, like Northwest, nwparkscience.org. You'll see a group of 17 short videos that talk about the scientific work in the national parks in the Northwest. Quite a few of them are based here at Olympic, but there's also some videos about Mount Rainier and North Cascades and the scientists in those parks talking about their research, why they do it, and what they do. And that's a great resource.
Yeah, I'm going to tune into it myself. I've seen a couple of them, but I want to see them all. Thank you so much for coming to speak with us and open our eyes a bit more to the wonders of the invertebrate world. And thank you so much for all your work on behalf of our environment.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. We have a few upcoming natural history events to tell you about.
Join the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society for an overview of the largest dam removals in the world so far, the demolition of the Glines Canyon Dam, which formed Lake Mills, and the Elwha Dam, which formed Lake Aldwell. The field trip is scheduled for Tuesday, August 15th. Go to jltnatural.org for details.
And next Thursday, August 17th, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter up in Squim for a walkabout looking for local land birds at the Dungeness Recreation Area. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
Finally, a heads up. As the Jefferson Land Trust invites you to join their annual fundraising extravaganza, Forest Fest 2017. It is happening this year on Thursday, August 24th, out at the Finn River Orchard in Chimicum, and will involve an evening of fine local food and drink while celebrating the power of community conservation. This event often sells out early, so act soon if you want to join in. Go to saveland.org for more details.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a common nighthawk, and I chose it for this week's sound because I've been hearing them a lot of late, especially with all the warm weather and the abundant insect life out at dusk. They are highly migratory and arrive relatively late to breed in our area, in early summer, and are most active at dawn and dusk, as they soar and swoop in flight, looking to scoop up insects in their wide gaping mouths. They can be found flying erratically in open habitats, forest clearings, gravelly areas, or weedy lots, looking rather like bats in flight. They belong to a group of birds called the goatsuckers, so named due to an ancient superstition that these birds suck the milk of goats at night for sustenance, and that family includes the poor whills that are so well known in the rest of the U.S. And they are most closely related to owls. During the breeding season, males take time out from foraging to perform display flights, flying high up in the air and then diving, ending with a booming sound as they break out of a fast dive. Vocalizations include a loud nasally buzz given in flight. The recording that we've played for you includes both of these distinctive sounds, and we'd like to thank Cornell University's great CD collection, Bird Songs of the Pacific Northwest, for the use of these recordings. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of August. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptc.org. As always,
happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Hair, performed by the Cowsills.
Beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxing, waxing. Give me down to there. Hair. Shoulder length longer. Hair. Here, baby, there, mama. Everywhere, daddy, daddy. Caught in the trees, give a home for the fleas in my hair. A home for the fleas, a hive for the buzzing bees. A nest for birds, there ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Grow it, show it, long as I can grow it, my hair.
I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, raggy, nasty.
Short.